Case number 12-1334, AGAP Church, Inc. et al. Petitioners v. Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Consovoy for Petitioners AGAP Church, Inc. et al. Mr. Schwartzman for Intervenor, National Hispanic Media Coalition. Mr. Marcus for Respondent FCC. And Mr. Brill for Intervenors Time Warner Cable, Inc. et al.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Will Consovoy on behalf of petitioners. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The order under review should be overturned for two overarching reasons. First, the agency's abrupt departure from its correct determination in 2007 that the plain meaning of Section 614B7 requires must-carry signals to be actually viewable on analog receivers is unsustainable under the APA and as a matter of statutory construction. Second, the order cannot be squared with the fundamental purposes of the 1992 Act's must-carry provisions to ensure that vulnerable broadcast television stations are not subject to disparate treatment by cable providers and to protect viewers of those stations from losing valuable programming.
Was the Commission's resolution the issue for all digital cable carriers?
With respect to they no longer have to provide it when the service goes all digital?
Right.
Yeah, no, that was not unlawful.
Why was that okay, but this is not. We have the same viewability requirement,
don't we? Right, and correct. And the viewability requirement is taken from the perspective, as the Commission has previously stated on several occasions, from the subscriber. So when the subscriber turns on their television, are the signals, is the television program there for them to see? And in the all-digital context, the cable operator shows up, they install the box, they make sure it's working, as they're required to under the viewability law, and when they turn on the television, the signal appears. That's what they departed from here by changing from actually viewable to capable of being viewed when you purchase release equipment.
But the theme of your brief and argument is an equal treatment kind of point, and I don't see how the word viewable gets you to that kind of equal treatment. Two things could be viewable but not equally treated, and I'm not sure I see the level playing field encompassed in the word viewable.
So, Your Honor, several points. One, we believe that the viewable needs to be read in context of the entire statutory provision, and Section 614B4A says there must be equality of carriage of signals. And read in that way.
Right. I think that's definitely an equality point, so that's helpful for you.
Yes. And then beyond that, this Court has held that all statutes must be read in light of their fundamental purpose. And the Commission has made clear in several orders, including the 2007 order, it said in paragraph 4, we adopt rules requiring the cable operators not discriminate. The Commission itself has recognized that the fundamental purpose of the 92 Act is to ban discrimination against these types of vulnerable broadcast stations and the viewers who wish to see this program.
I mean, discrimination in the area, this kind of regulation always means unreasonable discrimination. So it doesn't mean everything has to be treated identically. It never means that in the context of this sort of regulation.
Well, even if so, this would be unreasonable. And it goes back to the heart of what it means to be viewable. Again, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out, that's the fundamental word the Court is grappling with here. What does it mean for a signal to be viewable for the subscriber? And the way the Commission reads the word, it's redundant in two ways. Well, it's redundant and misplaced in two ways. First, the first sentence of Section 614B7 says the signal must be provided. So viewability must mean something different than provided. But the way the Commission interprets it, if all they must do is put the signal through the pipe and then the consumer has to figure out how to do it from there, that's no different than provided. So viewability must mean something more than that. But it also means something different than what's in the third sentence. And the third sentence talks about offer of equipment for sale or lease. So we know that when Congress uses a set of words in one sentence but not another, particularly in the same provision, we know it must mean something different. So viewability must fit somewhere between provided and offer of sale and lease for equipment. But their definition of capable of being reviewed violates both those rules. It requires it to be nothing more than provided and also to be accomplished through this use of equipment for sale or lease. It's a simply untenable construction of the statute. Whereas their 2007 construction of the statute is entirely tenable. It says, when I'm a subscriber and I turn on my television, I can watch the signal. That's the whole point of the statute, that the subscriber is protected, that the subscriber doesn't have to go out and figure out how to take a piece of equipment out of a box, hook it up to their television, hope it works, pay for it, and so on and so forth. That's the point. That's what the backstop of viewability is designed to do. And moreover, there's a second problem with their construction beyond it simply being wrong as a matter of law under step one of Chevron. They departed in violation of the reasoned decision-making requirement of the APA. If you look at page 23 of the commission's brief, I thought it was surprisingly candid. The commission says, we changed our interpretation of the statute because of changes in market conditions. But a statute that is clear
as points of Chevron to give agencies flexibility in light of changing circumstances?
If they are already at step two and they're choosing between two policies and one to be reasonable and one not, what the commission did here is something quite different. The commission said it was unambiguous on day one. It is now ambiguous on day two.
Why can't they just say we were wrong? We have a new president, new commission. We disagree with the prior interpretation. I don't see why that's somehow improper agency behavior.
In Fox, the Supreme Court made clear in the majority opinion and buttressed by Justice Kennedy that they must offer good reasons for the determination. Mm-hmm. A invalid reason, ignoring principles of statutory construction to reverse engineer.
That raises the question whether the original interpretation was right or wrong. Do you think if an agency says we unambiguously interpret the statute to mean X and that's wrong, we come to realize a few years later that they're bound for that?
No, they're not bound.
Okay, so why can't they just say we were wrong?
They have to say they're wrong, and that they have to explain why what they're doing now. And if the commission explains what it's doing,
explain why they think they're right now,
based on policy reasons. And this is a question of statutory construction. And
what would satisfy you in terms of an explanation?
Explaining using rules of statutory construction, the same sort of analysis they did in 2007.
What they said was the term viewable. So this really goes into their justification for the current interpretation, which is they said the term viewable does not require that it be viewable without a box. Right. And that's really the issue before us. I guess I don't see why the change means much anything here.
I won't belabor the point, but if the commission said we now think it's ambiguous, although we didn't before, and they said because we read a journal article from some international tribunal, and we think as a matter of law we're required to follow it, that would certainly be a problem under independent statutory analysis. It also wouldn't be a reasoned decision making.
Now you're resting on their initial assertion without a box or without a device. That's what you're saying they must continue to go forward with that original interpretation, reviewability without additional equipment.
Just to sharpen the point, it must be actually viewable. That was the interpretation. And in 2007, they interpreted actually viewable to mean that they would down-convert at the head end. That is what remains in the current order, actually. They say that it still remains the rule. They just added one new exception to the rule, and we think that exception is
about. Your argument, the arguments the petition has raised with respect to the use of a device is very confusing, because if that's why I'm trying to pin you down here, to see whether you've changed your thinking here, because without a device makes no sense. Well, the change in market includes changes in technology, and the devices have been used consistently. I think the fight is about who's going to put in and pay for the device.
I agree with that.
Okay, the way your argument is coming across. So, you seem to want to hang on that original interpretation as if to say without a device is a viable notion. It's not a viable notion. There are all kinds of these devices now. So your fight is, we understand they're going to have to stick something on top of whatever is there. They do it and they pay for it. That's what you're saying.
Just about.
That was your answer to my question on all digital. Right.
They installed that box.
That was the only difference.
So there were two aspects to the 2007 order. One, what does the statute require? Actual viewability. Second, how is that going to be satisfied? The commission determined that the best way and the right way to satisfy it was to down convert at the head end. Now, if the commission wants to...
With a device.
We're talking about the mechanics of assuring viewability. Aren't we in the absolute heartland of deference to the commission?
Well, the commission changed its interpretation of viewability. That's the key that unlocked
everything.
Only in
the context of this reference to these devices. I mean, that's where your briefs are really confusing.
And let me try to take one shot at clearing
it up. The devices aren't going anywhere now. They have to be there. Well, no, we may get to TVs that in years where...
Well, these viewers didn't use devices. These viewers, we're talking about these analog viewers, plugged the wire right in the wall.
At what point are you talking about, though?
Still today. Still some viewers today. They do not need a device. If the commission continues to... If they're not digital, if it's an analog signal, and they have an analog TV, they can plug in and receive the signals. What we're talking about here, and that was the whole point...
You mean on a down conversion?
Yes.
That is, that they have to put it in analog form to get to an analog-only TV.
Right. Now, if the court agrees with our interpretation that actual viewability versus capable of being viewed with leased or purchased equipment is the correct interpretation of the statute, and this case is remanded to the agency, we believe down conversion, the prior rule, which would remain in effect, is the right one. But how to meet the actual viewability requirement is a different question than whether that's not the requirement at all. And that's the key question in this case. The commission's point of view now is it doesn't have to be viewable, actually viewable. As long as you can go out on your own, purchase equipment,
Then it's actually reviewable.
It's capable.
The fight is just about, are you going to put the burden on them? Because you would agree, as I'm understanding you, if the commission has said, we're not going to stick with analog now. The world's moving away from that. It's perfectly reasonable for us to say we're going there. So we're going to allow that. But the cable, what you want is the cable companies have to put whatever the device is that's necessary to make that happen. They have to put it in. They have to pay for it.
They bear the burden of ensuring viewability, yes. How they bear that burden, we believe the prior rule remains the best way to
do it. But you see, you get viewability if the person goes out and buys the device.
That's where I disagree.
Okay, you don't?
If they have the burden of going out and buying the device that does not meet the viewability requirement.
Well,
it's the
burden of who's going to make the equipment satisfactory. It's certainly viewable if I have analog and I go buy the thing and I'm among the people who can do it and put it on and it works. I've got viewability.
May I respond, Your
Honor? Yeah, yeah, you're, yes, yeah. We got more.
You're saying I shouldn't have to do that.
Correct. So
because yesterday they had to down convert and now I have to go buy something?
Down conversion was the means by which they satisfied their viewability requirement.
Right.
The subscriber has no obligation under the statute.
But we're in a world now that wants to get away from analog, and so the commission is saying, well, we've got to move along. So you're saying, well, that's fine, move along, but don't make Harry go out and buy a device and pay for it to get the same viewability he had yesterday with analog.
I don't want to say that we're fine moving along, because I think that would mischaracterize our position. What I would say
is... I tried to sneak that in to see what you got. You caught me.
But what I would say is, it's the burden of the cable operator to figure out a solution to the problem, not the burden of the viewer to figure out how to make the signals work.
Didn't the commission take that into account by saying the boxes must be widely available and affordable and therefore...
They're going to regulate their rates, mm-hmm, if necessary.
Okay, responses to both questions. At step two, they said... They included this price limitation, although it's not really a price limitation, and we can get into that as well. But again, they only get there. They changed their interpretation of the statute. They admit that they did. They say,
but that's not impermissible in the Chevron regime. That's what Chevron's about.
If they get to step two, they do not get to step two here. This statute is unambiguous. It requires
that's argument, whatever its validity, is completely independent of what the agency said before.
Right.
Just to determine whether or not it's ambiguous or unambiguous.
Exactly.
Assuming that the two steps of Chevron are mandatory steps.
Yeah, so you can't ride that. I mean, Judge Winters, we're all sitting here thinking you can't ride their original interpretation as locked on Chevron 1, because we can look at that and say, no, that's...
And we'd be glad for the court to look at it, and we believe when the court does, they will see that our interpretation of the statute, which the commission previously agreed with, is the right interpretation of the statute.
So on the quality of carriage language, which I think helps you, but the commission responds, although briefly, that really has nothing to do with this kind of issue. It's more of a technical specifications, technical standards issue. Doesn't have anything to do with the box kind of issue.
The commission never really addresses what our argument was. The commission, the statute says both quality of spectrum and quality of carriage, and they would like to read the statute to only include the former and don't deal with the latter. And it's the latter that's the focus of this case. Again, signal quality and carriage can't mean the same thing. And the natural meaning of carriage would encompass this kind of situation where a signal quality would be something entirely different. And they don't really address the quality of carriage point at all.
Now, what about the First Amendment? The commission relied on that constitutional avoidance doctrine as a thumb on the scale here.
So we do not believe that constitutional avoidance is applicable to this case for several reasons. First, the commission did not validly invoke the doctrine. The most the commission was willing to say in the order was our prior reading renders the constitutional footing somewhat less certain.
Why is that an invalid invocation of the doctrine?
The commission has to take the position, at a minimum, that there are serious constitutional questions here.
Now, the absence of the word serious, you're really riding in on that?
The argument, I would say, is not serious. If you look at the 2007 order, I'm not relying on it, I'm just looking at it as a way of an example, they spent 14 and a half pages explaining why there was absolutely no First Amendment problems here. In this order, they have a few sentences explaining that it might render the footing unconstitutional, less certain. And in your Tennis Channel opinion, Judge Kavanaugh, you had a footnote 4 which said there's a really serious question here about they may have to actually say that the statute is unconstitutional to get the benefit of the avoidance doctrine, or at a minimum show why there's a serious constitutional question. But even if they met that burden, there's no serious constitutional question here. This is the exact provision.
How can it not be a serious constitutional question? Musk Carey's been around for a long time. The market's changed dramatically. Cable operators don't have the bottleneck that they did. I mean, it's got to be at least serious, doesn't it?
I respectfully disagree. That's a stare decisis question under Turner. This is the exact...
Turner didn't say if the market changes dramatically, you still need to stick with a picture of the market that has no relation to reality.
I think this is bound up in cases like Agostini and of that sort, where the Supreme Court has said it's not for the courts of appeals to guess at.
But in any event, this is dual Muscari, right? So this is a different from the original Muscari requirement. Right?
It is not dual Muscari, and the commission has not argued otherwise. In the 2007 order, in a place that they haven't changed their opinion, they said that this type of obligation is in fact not dual Muscarriage. And that remains binding since they didn't reverse that determination. And it's not. The viewer gets one signal. If they're an analog viewer, they get an analog signal. If they're a digital viewer, they get a digital signal. Dual must carry is when one viewer turns on their television and gets duplicative of the same channel. That's not occurring here. This is not dual must carry.
But it's crowding, and the requirement here is crowding out, because they have to do both. It crowds out other networks that otherwise might appear, right? You're aware C-SPAN was arguing here a few years ago that they were being crowded out by this requirement and networks like that.
And that was the same argument they made in Turner. And the argument is bound by Turner.
Turner didn't involve this digital analog comparison and figures 12 to 1 in terms of the ratio of what could be transmitted by digital.
Right, but Turner did involve the viewability provision. It's one of the provisions that was upheld in Turner, and this is merely an application of the provision. The provision hasn't changed. The only question is how do we interpret and implement the provision in light of the digital transfer, which is one of the key problems here. Congress mandated digital transition for broadcasters, and cable operators are not mandated to, and they're not completing digital transition. If they were, they wouldn't have any problem at all. This is a circumstance of their own making, that they have declined to finish the digital transition on the cable side and want relief from the viewability rule. But it's there to stop exactly that behavior. This is exactly what the viewability rule and the overall must-carry provisions were designed to stop. Cable providers wanting to bump off must-carry stations in order to appeal to higher-end customers on the digital side, or their higher-end customers And they down-convert, and they do this for other people. They do it for larger broadcasters. They have no problem using the space to down-convert to analog.
Well, and all the commission's doing is removing the preferential treatment that your clients receive, so making sure that everyone's treated equally now.
Well, to the extent that there's preferential
everyone's treatment, operating in the same marketplace without the preferential treatment that your clients have received under the prior regime.
What they're doing is, Your Honor, hurting the subscriber. So the subscriber is the beneficiary of the must-carry statute. That is who Congress sought to protect, along with these broadcasters.
Depends if the subscriber wants C-SPAN or wants the local broadcaster, right?
Congress made the
you don't know what. That's a blanket statement that presumes subscribers want something that the market otherwise wouldn't dictate.
Well, Congress made the determination that this is what subscribers want, this is what subscribers need, and that determination was upheld by the Supreme Court in Turner 2.
Standing here today, what are the interests that justify this?
The same interests that were at issue in Turner. The same three parts.
Identify those?
The widespread dissemination of viewpoints, protecting the existence of over-the-air broadcasting, and ensuring fair competition. Those three remain as valid today as they were then, but again, it's not at issue in this case, because Turner is binding precedent. This precise
just on that. I saw these issues as matters of degree, and here you're talking about a very substantial inclusion of capacity in the interests of 8% of the market. So we're told, you chastised the commission for dividing 16 by 2 in transition from its opinion to its brief, but a lot of us are able to handle that.
There are always going to be questions. These same arguments could be made about Turner itself. These are the same arguments.
No, let me try it this way. Well, I don't want to interrupt your answer to Judge Williams.
No. The commission doesn't have discretion to violate the statute. And they may think that there are better ways to use this spectrum. But that's not their decision.
We're on the constitutional point. It seems to me that Turner, this decision that places itself at the margin of what conditions were at the time. It didn't say that the rights of the benefited broadcasters covered by Turner were absolute and entitled to squash every interest, no matter what might happen.
All I would submit, Your Honor, is Turner has to stand for, at a minimum, that the provisions that were upheld in that statute, Section 614 and Section 615, are constitutional, and nothing more is required.
The question is whether the proposed application poses a serious constitutional issue.
And it can't, because if the commission went back to its prior construction, that construction would be lawful because it follows directly from Turner. It is the exact provision. In other words, the prior construction of Section 614, as the Commission explained in 2007, is bound by Turner.
You're effectively saying that once a statute is upheld, every application of the statute is necessarily constitutional. It seems to me an non sequitur.
The question,
U.S. reports are chock full of cases finding the opposite.
No one has asserted here that this is an as-applied challenge to the statute. This is, they're saying, and their interveners also say, well, the interveners are the only ones really saying it, not the commission. The commission has not said this. The commission has not said that if the prior construction were to be restored under our statutory construction arguments, that the statute would be unconstitutional. They haven't.
They said it would raise constitutional issues.
The application would raise constitutional issues. Application.
That's not how I read their brief. They say one vague assertion about rendering the constitutional footing uncertain. But in any respect, regardless of what the commission's position is, this is not an as-applied challenge of Section 614.
Right, just on your stare decisis point, if the Supreme Court says because of the cable bottleneck and because of the threat to local broadcasters, the statute in current conditions is constitutional, and then if the cable bottleneck disappears and there really isn't as serious a threat to local broadcasters, doesn't that knock out the the legs of the conclusion and require us to independently assess where the market stands now.
It may allow the Supreme Court to reassess it, but respectfully not this court. That's why changed factual circumstances is one of the factors in the stare decisis test. If it wasn't, and courts were free to reassess the factual circumstances themselves, it would be redundant of that stare decisis factor. And this could be true of any constitutional argument. You could imagine a case involving a fundamental right of some kind where the parties say, well, the facts have changed.
Right.
And that's not how the vertical heart stare decisis works. Turner upheld Section 614 and 615, and it remains good law.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I think this case can be resolved on the Communications Act issue, but if the court does want to reach the APA issues, I think there's a strong notice and comment argument, but I'll leave that to the briefs. I'd like to focus instead on why the Commission's decision was arbitrary and capricious. And I want to focus on the fact that the Commission entirely ignores the rights of over-the-air viewers. Viewers are the ultimate beneficiaries of the Communications Act, and the Commission recognized it in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, but ignored it in the order. These are the ones who are actually going to experience the greater degree of harm if the stations that they're dependent on must carry lose their viability and their service degrades or they go off the air. Turner once said, protecting non-cable households is an important federal interest. Now, these are disproportionately people of color, people with low income, who cannot afford...
It was an interest that A, trumps all other interests in the universe, and it didn't say that a burden of the size found by the Commission here is excessive.
No, Your Honor, but the Commission entirely ignored, and that's why it's arbitrary and capricious. The brief trivializes the interest. You discussed the 16% to 8%, but there's 10% of viewers are over-the-air viewers who don't subscribe to cable or satellite. It's really 18%. And 8% plus 10%.
I'm sorry, how were they affected?
Well, if the must-carry stations lose their viability, their service degrades, they go off the air, the over-the-air viewers are harmed more than they have other choices.
I get you, but that is right. An intermediate step.
Yeah.
Driving the television.
That's right, Your Honor.
Business.
So the Commission says, well, the glass is 82% full.
On the record that a significant number are on the edge, and this is likely to kick them over the edge?
Well, yes. The ex parte traffic in the weeks after the trade press story appeared from a number of the stations, I can't cite you to particular ones in the joint appendix, but there certainly were arguments that these are marginal stations to begin with. These are niche stations. If there were stronger stations, they'd be selecting retransmission consent to begin with. These are by definition the weaker stations. So the Commission says, well, 82% the glass is full. And my concern is that they don't discuss the 18% glass empty. There's a discussion of harm in 308 to 309 of the Joint Appendix. The heading is effect on must-carry stations, cable operators, and consumers. But there's not a word about viewers or consumers in that section. There's one paragraph about the impact on broadcasters, one section on the impact on cable, but there's no discussion of that. And that then bleeds into the next point, which is that there's no record on which to determine that $2 a month is affordable. In the encryption proceeding, which involved a somewhat analogous situation, the Commission required free equipment. There was no provision for education of consumers in this kind of circumstance. And I would point out that because of cord cutting, the number of over-the-air viewers is actually starting to increase again. So this isn't some sort of diminishing thing and the commission is looking forward and saying, well, this problem is going away. This is a problem that's going to continue. So I think it was arbitrary and capricious for the commission not to signal what it was going to do, not to create a record on this, not to ask questions about it, and then make a determination based on a two-page letter 2 weeks before the 3 weeks before the decision from the cable association saying, well, the eight largest operators are going to make sure that that boxes are available at an affordable price. Well, the American Cable Association, which filed, and here's the small cable operators, there's 800 of them, and they said our equipment costs are higher, so we've got problems. For all those reasons, I think it's arbitrary and capricious, and the commission really had no record basis on which to take this action.
Do we know, maybe I'm out of it in my understanding, do we know for sure that there is an equation that's implicit in your argument that the small broadcasters who might be hurt are predominantly watched by poorer people?
Yes,
Intuitively, I don't know why that's necessarily so.
Because these tend to be foreign.
People with money don't watch small broadcasts.
Well, the record shows these tend to be foreign language stations. They tend to be religious stations, and they tend to be non-affiliated stations. These are marginal stations.
No, the marginality of the stations doesn't tell me anything about who's watching. There may be people with a lot of money who are watching those stations. Why does it necessarily follow that foreign language stations and religious stations are only watched by poor people?
Well, it's not that they're only watched by poor people, but they're disproportionately watched by poor people and people of color. Well, there is, I can't cite you to specifics in the record, but there is record information about that, and the commission itself found it in 2007.
I'll ask them. It's such a strange assumption to me without some clear evidence. I don't know why it follows. I can understand with certain stations that might be the case, but I don't think it necessarily follows that certain kinds of small educational stations are only watched by poor people who would be burdened if they have to buy a device. That's implicit in your argument.
Yes, indeed, it is, Your Honor, and I think there is record support for it.
Okay.
Well, is part of your argument that the people who still watch over the air, there would be nothing to watch?
Well, it's not that there would be nothing to watch, there would be less to watch. And as I said at the beginning, this was one of the interests that Congress was concerned about, maintaining a viable broadcast sector. And in that regard, Turner 2 is very explicit. This is not just a fight between broadcasters and cable operators. This is a legitimate congressional concern about having a viable over-the-air broadcast ecosystem. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Marcus?
May it please the Court, I'm Joel Marcus for the FCC. This is obviously a statutory case, and in statutory cases, Chevron applies, as the Court is well aware. And at the first step of Chevron, the Court has to determine whether the statute is unambiguous. That is, it can only have one meaning at all. And if it's unambiguous, the Court must apply that unambiguous meaning. We believe this is a Chevron Step 2 case, that the word viewable is an ambiguous word. It has a meaning capable of being seen, but in the circumstances that are presented here, it doesn't address the critical question, which is how is the signal capable of being seen? It doesn't by itself require any particular way of achieving that capability. And there are, in fact, several ways. One way, and the way the Commission chose in 2007, would be for the cable system to provide an analog signal. And in that case, the signal is certainly viewable to somebody with a cable-ready analog television set. But another way, and seemingly nowadays the more predominant way, is for the cable system to provide a signal that has to be converted or, in some cases, decrypted by a device that's located in the customer's home. Keep in mind that even in the case of an analog signal being provided to a cable-ready television set, there is a device at issue. It's just built into the television set. So nothing is inherently viewable in this world. Everything has to be converted from one format to another somewhere along the line. And so the question, I think, then becomes, was the Commission's interpretation of viewable in the circumstances presented here and in the market that the Commission was facing at the time it was addressing this, was that a reasonable interpretation?
So you focused on viewable, understandably, because that's the primary focus of petitioners, but there's also the quality of carriage.
Okay, and that has to do with the discrimination point, Judge
Kavanaugh. Yeah, well, right. That's their argument is primarily about discrimination, as I see it.
I think that that is an element of their argument, and they're saying that there can be no type of carriage at all that's in any way different from the type of carriage that's provided by
different. It just can't be
okay.
Worse.
So their argument rests on section 4A, mm-hmm. and that section is called non-degradation and technical specifications. And if you don't mind, it's worth reading the statute. It's not very long. And it says, the signals of local commercial stations that the cable operator carries shall be carried without material degradation. That's the standard. That's what Congress is trying to achieve here. In other words, when you turn your set on, the picture you're going to see on, you know, NBC or pick your must-carry station, NBC isn't typically a must-carry, is not going to be a worse picture than the one that you're going to see on ESPN, you know, the cable-owned network. And then it goes on to say, the Commission shall adopt carriage standards, that's the rules governing carriage, to ensure that, to the extent technically feasible, the quality of signal processing and carriage is the same for the two types of stations.
So, and now, though, if you turn it on and you don't have the box, you get a blank screen. So that's materially degraded. It's completely degraded.
Well, I mean, right. If you turn it on, if you're a digital subscriber and you turn it on, you don't get anything either.
If you're the people that are the focus of this, if you turn it on and you don't have the box, you're not going to see the station at all, right?
Well, I think that...
Is that correct? Because I may not understand the technology. That's correct, right?
You are correct that if there's a digital signal being provided and you don't have a digital-capable television set, you will not get a picture.
Right.
Isn't that correct.
Isn't that materially degraded to the point of not seeing it at all?
It's not being degraded in the sense that it's getting any kind of technically worse carriage than any other kind of digital signal.
It's a lot worse.
It's a lot worse. If you don't see it in ESPN's clear, that's bad. But if you can't see it in ESPN's clear, that's great.
Right, but of course, all you have to do is get the box. Hmm. And then
I know,
and
that's,
then all the all
the
stations will look
the
same.
That's the point.
So let's take a look at what the commission said about this.
And you don't have to get the box for ESPN. You do have to get it for this station.
Okay, but that is a kind of general non-discrimination provision. Let's take a look at what the commission said about this. This is in paragraph 10 of the order at JA 303, mm-hmm. and it's about halfway through the paragraph there in 10, and it says it's not even clear that this provision applies here. It speaks to the...
Right, I read that, and then I said, why?
And it doesn't address the issue of viewability. Oh, because then it goes on to say, from a technical standpoint, a must-carry signal carried in standard definition arguably has the same, quote, quality of signal and carriage, signal processing and carriage, as a signal carried in analog format. In other words, it's about the... Once you can see the signal, the question is your picture going to be worse for the... over-the-air stations than it's going to be for the cable-owned networks, and it's about what the viewer sees. You know, essentially, assuming that the viewer has the equipment to see anything, but that question, whether the viewer can see anything, that's the viewability question. That's the question that the commission was dealing with here. What does it mean to make the signal viewable? If you can't see the signal at all, Judge Kavanaugh, it's obviously not viewable. Going back to where I started.
The point is, it's viewable with a box. I mean, that's your argument.
That's right, exactly.
But the question then is the quality of carriage the same when you have to get the box? That's all I've stumbled on. That got less attention in your brief, I thought.
I apologize if we didn't address it for the court's satisfaction. But I do think we did say that Congress knew how to draw a broad anti-discrimination requirement when it wanted to. And that's at page 44 of our brief, and it cites section 338D, which has to do with DVS, and it says satellite video distributors must, quote, provide access to television station signal at a non-discriminatory price and in a non-discriminatory manner. And so
this says you have to provide the same quality of processing and carriage. And that sounds
right, but in a technical way. Keep in mind the title of this thing is technical specifications.
Right.
They're talking about that
may create the ambiguity.
They're talking about I don't know how the engineering works, but the amount of cycles per second, refresh rates, things like that, that would make the picture materially worse for somebody watching an over-the-air must carry station than it would be for somebody watching the cable operator's own owned networks.
So this is a bit of a bank shot, but I guess in the EchoStar order, and this is cited by petitioners, the commission said that satellite providers couldn't require you to get a second dish to get the must carry. And that's based on a statutory provision that in turn cross-references this provision.
That's right. But that provision that I just read to you is a much broader kind of blanket non-discrimination requirement.
But it cross-references this one, right? Doesn't it say that standards should be comparable to this one?
Well, certainly the technical standard should be comparable, but the language of the DBS statute is much broader than the language of this statute, which is really quite significantly focused on the technical aspects of processing and carriage. And there is a lot of, electronics that go on here, and there are a lot of things that a cable operator could presumably do to a signal to make it worse, even if you did have all the requisite equipment.
I'm sure I'm understanding your answer on degradation. You seem not so concerned. Using the ESPN example, they will down-convert their own signals to an analog broadcaster, right? So the question is, what are they going to do in carrying the signals of broadcasters? And under the new rule, they're not required to down-convert anymore. The user has got to go get a box.
Well, in fact,
right?
Let
me make sure I understand the picture.
It depends on what on the cable operator has discretion on what programming is carried on the basic tier and what programming is carried.
Yeah, yeah, but I understand. Using ESPN as an example, they on their own, for their own material, will down convert
right
to the analog user.
Right.
Then there's another decision to make with respect to the must carry group of broadcasters who have to offer programs in digital, and under the existing regime, ESPN don't have to do anything because the people receiving have to go get a box and they have to pay for it, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So
as a factual matter, you are correct.
Alright, so what Judge Kavanaugh was saying to you with respect to that group, they turn on the television and go see a blank screen.
Well, I think where we part ways is that the commission interpreted the non-degradation technical specifications provision as not just a blanket non-discrimination, you can't have any differences in treatment between these two different types of signals, but rather it had to do specifically with the technical aspects of the signal. And the
that doesn't mean anything to me. I want to sit up here and look intelligent. I don't know what you just said.
and that's fair enough. If you want to look at the television, and what you want is when you have all your equipment in place, when you turn to ESPN, you don't get a significantly better picture than you do when you turn to
won't downgrade. That's not degradation. The highest form of degradation.
What I said was assuming that the equipment was already in place.
And if they went out and bought it,
right,
ESPN can't show picture of their own than the broadcasters.
Yes, yes. And so the question, Judge Edwards, whether you have the equipment to even view a signal, that's the viewability question. That's the statute that we're principally dealing with here. And the question of whether you can see the picture better on one than you do on the other, that's the non-degradation technical specifications issue. And I think the commission interpreted that statute. It didn't need to spend a lot of time on it, but it did directly address the question, and I think it gave a complete and satisfactory answer based on the language of these statutes. And I think that, again, we amplified in our brief that Congress does know how to draw a more general non-discrimination statute when it wants to, one that's not specifically focused on the picture quality issues and the technical issues.
You don't want to rest on what we assume Congress might or might not do, right, do you?
I'm more comfortable with what the commission does or doesn't do, but
On the First Amendment thumb on the scale, Mr. that the commission had or at least referenced, Mr. Consvoy responds that whatever First Amendment analysis you might conduct on other provisions, given the changed market, that Turner's the law, and we have to stick with Turner, and therefore the First Amendment is no thumb on the scale for at least this particular issue. Can you respond to that?
I don't think that the First Amendment is no thumb on the scale here. Turner established a lot of things. One of the things that Turner did establish is that cable operators are engaged in speech, and that when a statute or FCC rule requires them to provide one sort of speech and that means that they can't provide another sort of speech of their own choosing, that is a burden on their constitutional rights. And there's no question that is one of the fundamental principles of Turner. That's, in fact, how the opinion actually starts out.
So I may have missed it. I have seen the commission, when they want to address a constitutional issue that they want to avoid, do it. And I must say, on this record, I don't see them seriously raising. I mean, it's someone, counsel probably said, throw in a couple of sentences, but there's no serious amplification of a constitutional issue here that the commission purports to be relying on.
I think that the commission was, as Judge Kavanaugh, I think, aptly put it, putting a thumb on the scale. So it was dealing with an ambiguous statute that had to be interpreted to mean something.
You've got to explain what you mean if you want to put a thumb on the scale.
Well, I think what it said was, given the amount of space an analog channel takes up and the amount of programming that could be digital programming that could be substituted for the analog channel, that there is an intrusion on the cable operator's First Amendment rights to some degree by requiring them to carry the analog channel rather than the 12 streams of digital channels. Keep in mind,
to continue with the existing regime, which they found posed no constitutional issues.
Well, okay.
Somehow the thumb appears? I'm not getting it, really. They did not amplify this point. It's one thing if they rest on it, and then I got to take it seriously. But they have previously said the regime they're walking away from was perfectly constitutional in their view.
Well, okay, so can I make two points? One is that you don't really need to address the constitutional issues here to affirm the commission. So it's a little bit, this discussion is interesting, but I think not necessary ultimately to the court's resolution of the case. But what the commission was dealing with was, in the 2007 order, a balance of interests. There's the intrusion on the constitutional rights on one hand, and there's the interest to be fulfilled on the other hand. And what the commission was dealing with 5 years later was a vastly changed market where the intrusion was still the same, but it was very likely possible that the interests on the other side of the balance had changed significantly. So, in other words,
I'm not doubting that there could be a question, and it might even be a serious question. All I'm suggesting is the commission hasn't pushed it here.
The commission didn't push it here, I don't think, because it really needed to push it
in order for it
to be sustained. And like I said, Judge Edwards, I think that the court need not reach the potentially difficult constitutional merits here because that requires potentially consideration of record factors that aren't presented. And it's entirely possible, in fact, quite easy in my view, for the court to affirm the commission here without reaching the constitutional question, although I do think that it is a valid concern that the commission raised in determining which course of action to take here.
And it has independent authority to expand availability of various things that come through television, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's part one of the Communications Act.
Digital capacity preempted by analog is entirely relevant, completely independent of the Constitution.
I think that's true. And that could very well be a factor that with the commission could legitimately rely upon. And so that all it maximizes.
They
did,
yeah. Didn't they rely on it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Then. So if the court has no further questions, I think that I will sit down and just with the closing thought that we urge the court to affirm this case, which is, I think, a straight down the middle Chevron 2 issue, which involved a very reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute.
Thank you, Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Brill?
May it please the court. I'd like to pick up on the constitutional issues because we vehemently dispute the notion that Turner somehow forecloses consideration of the First Amendment issues in this case or that it controls the outcome of this case. And if anything, if Turner controls, it precludes the broadcaster's argument that cable operators should be required to carry not only a digital version of a must-carry signal, but also a duplicative and highly inefficient and capacity-consuming analog version. The Turner 2 decision never considered the viewability requirements in isolation. And as Judge Williams' questions before went to, what's at issue here is entirely an as-applied challenge. The question is whether the broadcasters can compel the commission to read this statute as imposing a requirement that on top of the digital must-carry right that remains in place and that remains in effect, there should be, must be, an additional obligation to carry the signal at the head end in analog and to deliver it only in that format. In other words, to preclude cable operators from exercising discretion to meet viewability in some other manner.
But for those analog-only subscribers, the fact that digital must carry is irrelevant, right, for them, because they're not going to have the digital capacity. So only with the analog must carry are they going to be able to see the stations.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's at all irrelevant because
what the
broadcasters are doing here is equating the denial of carriage that was at issue in the Turner cases with an equipment solution here that doesn't deny carriage at all. Judge Williams, your dissents in the Turner cases would have credited the AB switch in that case. This is much different and much easier from the consumer standpoint. This isn't a function of getting an over-the-air signal through a mechanical device where you have to get up off the couch.
The question is whether Congress could determine, consistent with the First Amendment, that the AB switch wasn't adequate. While here, that's not an issue.
No, here it's...
As you say, it's a question of whether the broadcasters compel the commission to provide what they like.
Yeah, and here, in answer to your question, Judge Kavanaugh, the analog cable viewers are not being precluded from accessing those digital signals. They're just being told if they want access to them, they have to get an inexpensive, small converter device.
It's back in 1992, the cable operators had said, oh, you can get the must-carry stations, but you got to get a separate box. That wouldn't have worked, right?
Well, I'm not sure it wouldn't have worked. I mean, I think in Judge Williams' view, it would have. But I think there are dramatic differences between the facts that applied in Turner and in the early 90s and today.
From the perspective of the person with the analog-only TV, who gets subscription to analog-only cable, it's the same as in 1992, right? Which is, I want to be able to turn on the TV and get the must-carry station, and I can't do that without getting some extra piece of equipment.
But Your Honor, Justice Kennedy's opinion makes clear that the impact on one individual subscriber wasn't the issue at all. It was the overall impact on the viability of broadcasting. And that was determined to be at issue because 60% of the viewing audience at that time relied on cable, and cable was seen as a bottleneck. Analog cable subscribership today makes up about 8% of the audience. So what we're talking about is an assertion based entirely on speculation that making it inconvenient or up to $2 per month necessary for those analog cable subscribers to view the signals, wholly apart from whether some of them may have set-top boxes today. We just don't know that from the record. So, but even if you assume the worst, this 8%, none of them have digital televisions, none of them have set-top boxes, the assertion for First Amendment purposes would have to be that that somehow the loss of advertising revenues from that small segment of the population is going to cause large numbers of stations to fail. The reason for the remand from Turner 1 to Turner 2 is that the Supreme Court decided there wasn't concrete enough evidence as to the viability issue. Here, there's nothing in the record, zero, to suggest there's a threat to the viability of broadcasting. Justice Kennedy made clear that the loss of a few stations wouldn't have been sufficient. And the evidence, we think, even though still very close in the 90s, pointed out that there were bankruptcies and large numbers of stations with serious harms. At least that was the asserted record. Today, though, there's nothing in this record, nothing at all, to suggest that the loss of some portion or even the entirety of this analog cable population would jeopardize the ability to reach the over-the-air audience. There's just a failure of proof on that key issue. And
do you think digital must carry itself as constitutional in the current market?
I don't, Your Honor, and I think that's probably a question for another day, but I think that the...
Just curious about your view.
The factual changes today, the loss of a bottleneck, we think completely undermines that requirement, and we think courts can reach it. The Voting Rights Act decision last month, Justice Roberts made clear that constitutional...
The Supreme Court can do that,
but I think it emphasized that all constitutional burdens need to be measured based on the current burden and the current facts. And that is a question for another day, but we think that makes this an easy case, that because must-carry remains in place, and we haven't challenged it here, and we are carrying all those signals, the only question is whether we can be compelled to carry a signal a second time and in a remarkably intrusive and burdensome way, and we think the answer to that is clearly no.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kotzfoye, give you a few minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few brief points in rebuttal. Judge Edwards, your point about quality of carriage got right to the heart of this case. The cable providers are happy to down-convert cable programming. They are happy to down-convert programming for larger broadcasters. They just don't want to down-convert this particular vulnerable broadcast programming. That violates the quality of carriage in every respect, and that is sufficient to resolve this case. Second, whether this case is resolved at step one or
well,
step...
Well, their point on quality of carriage, just to stop you there, because that's an important point, is that it's at least ambiguous what quality of carriage is referring to in terms of the technical standards. How do you respond to that?
We don't believe it's ambiguous at all. We believe quality of carriage has to mean something different than quality of signal. The statute uses both words. It wouldn't have used both if they meant the same thing. And the Commission has not offered this Court any independent definition or meaning for the word carriage. Their entire reading is it's all signal. It's all grades of degradation in signals. But that would deprive the word carriage of any meaning in the statute. So we think whether it's a step one or a step two issue, that reading is completely unreasonable. And more broadly, about the reading of the viewability requirement, it also fails at either step one or step two. And the key problem that the Commission has made, or the key mistake it has made, is that it has converted a statute that is designed to protect viewers and impose an obligation on cable providers to find a technological solution, to now require the viewer to go out and solve their own technical problems by reaching out to the cable provider, by acquiring a box, to figuring out how to install it, and hope it works. And that's what must-carry was designed to stop. It was designed to keep cable providers from creating roadblocks to viewing must-carry signals. Whether the Court sees that as a step one or a step two issue, it's unreasonable. It violates the fundamental purpose of the statute, and the Commission has offered no explanation how its reading gives any meaning to the word provided in the first sentence or does not depart from the meaning of the third sentence where they use the words sale or lease of equipment. Congress knows how to use those words. If it wanted viewability to allow for the use of sold or leased equipment, it would have said so. It said that was okay for additional televisions, but for the primary television in the home, Congress wanted to make sure that the viewer was not burdened. And if anything, there's no question that this rule burdens the viewer at the expense of the cable provider. And finally, I think the arguments from the Commission and intervener have made clear that there are no First Amendment questions in this case. The Commission doesn't seriously think there is one, and the interveners don't think anything the Court can do can solve it. That is the last time, that is the last place where the court would think to invoke constitutional avoidance. What the commission has done is essentially First Amendment hand waving. They have not explained how there would be a real First Amendment problem here. They have not departed from their 2007 order, which said that Turner controlled unviewability. There's nothing in this order that departs from the statement that, that Turner is binding with respect to the viewability requirement. And that is the end of the matter as far as the First Amendment should go. So with that, unless the court has further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.